This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly update from Congress, including today's meeting. President Obama talked to congressional leaders about the next steps in Iraq.
First, though, we're talking about some of the severe weather around Wisconsin this week. The National Weather Service says about six tornadoes touched down in Wisconsin late Monday and early Tuesday. They are the first tornadoes of the year.
And that's a late start to the tornado season in Wisconsin, the latest start since 1962. Usually runs from May to July, but 2014 had been pretty quiet so far. But it doesn't mean we're in for a mild tornado season, according to weather experts.
That's right. Chad Franzen is with us now. He is a meteorologist for WSAW-TV in Wausau. And Chad, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Well, we're doing pretty well. We're sort of drying out for the moment, as is a good chunk of the state, and it looks like we have some more to come. Typical tornado season in Wisconsin apparently runs from May to July. This year it's running a little bit late. When did the first tornado touch down in Wisconsin this year?
This year it was just this past 24 or 48 hours now that we had that very first one happen. And overall, you know, we had that long spring, or excuse me, a very short spring, but kind of a long winter.
Mm-hmm.
So things, the weather patterns are not very summer-like. They're just getting that way now, when typically in the past that we've had this set up maybe at the last part of May. Now it seems like the weather patterns may be 3 or 4 weeks behind. So while it was nice to be able to go such a long period into the season without a tornado, now we had some active weather, and it's going to be kind of on and off with the active storms here in the course of the next couple of days.
So let's talk a little bit about the weather conditions that lead to tornadoes. You mentioned that the sort of the absence of a spring, we had that long extended winter, was not helpful in helping tornadoes to come to Wisconsin. Why is that? And then to sort of flip that on its head, what are the weather conditions that are conducive to tornadoes?
Sure. You know, we get a delay in that weather pattern, and usually when we get into very strong to severe thunderstorms, we need a clash of the air masses, so to speak. Well, it took Wisconsin a long time to really kind of warm up and get into the warmer weather, so that's why we kind of saw a delayed start to the summer severe weather season, which, as you mentioned earlier, typically runs late May through the last part of July. This year, now it's kind of starting in the middle of June and probably will make it into the first part of August. And what we typically talk about as a meteorologist when you're looking at these severe storms is you need a clash of the air masses. You need a warm, humid air mass out ahead of a system, and usually some kind of a front or some kind of a triggering mechanism to trigger that warm, humid air mass to really blow up into these thunderstorms. Think of it as a pot of boiling water on the stove and the lid on it. Once you get that mechanism to pull that lid off, you see that rapid expanse of the gas into the air, and that's how these thunderstorms really develop. And we've been basically stuck along a boundary that's over Wisconsin, back through Nebraska and Iowa, and now we're just seeing repeated chances of these stronger storms. And case in point was the last couple of nights.
Yeah, it feels as though we're sort of stuck in a pattern over the last couple of days. Is that typically what happens, that you get into a pattern and then it takes a while for us to get out of it?
Well, usually when we get into a summer situation or summer severe weather situation, Wisconsin isn't known for these training events where they constantly, continually happen back to back to back. In the summertime, you usually get one or two days of these warm, humid situations, a couple of strong thunderstorms, and it's done. Here, this pattern set up on Sunday, and for the most part is going to be with us until we get around to the end of the week. So maybe in years past and summers past, a more typical summer strong storm, severe storm setup is a day or two, and it's done. This week has been pretty much all week long. We will have some stronger thunderstorms again, especially southwestern Wisconsin, late tonight and again for tomorrow night and even into Friday as well.
Now, as the season got off to a late start, I imagine a lot of people are hopeful that what that means is then that the season will be shorter, or that we'll wind up having fewer tornadoes as part of the season. Is there any way you can predict the length of the season at this point?
Well, there's some speculation right now that an El Nino is going to set up later this summer into the wintertime. And El Ninos in Wisconsin are better known for typically milder winter times. What could happen is, as this El Nino continues to kind of warm up the abnormal waters of the Pacific Ocean, warming up, as it sets up later in the summertime, our summer severe weather season may be pushed into maybe that first couple of weeks of August, when traditionally maybe it ends closer to the end of July. So the season overall could still be a 2 to 3 month season with chances for summer severe weather. But of course, when you're talking long-term patterns, certainly that could easily change. But my prognosis at this point is we'll probably have a pretty active pattern on and off through the rest of summer and even into the early part of August.
And in terms of numbers or the possibility of numbers of tornadoes, I imagine it's also a little too early right now to make that prediction that it's going to be a busy year or not busy year for tornadoes.
Yes, correct. It is pretty early to be able to do that. On average, the most tornado-prone month in Wisconsin is usually July, and it's actually that late July, first week of August time frame, although June certainly does see a peak in tornadoes, just not as quite as large as that time frame. So my guess is we'll see more occurrences like this as we get into July, and we'll probably have a pretty typical summer severe weather season. And let's hope for the latter. Let's hope that we just don't get the tornadic storms again. But the season's just really kind of starting up across Wisconsin.
Now, in a typical year, how many tornadoes wind up touching down or being recorded in Wisconsin?
I'm looking at a 20-year average, the last 20 years in Wisconsin. And we're talking about 23 to 24 a year. And that's just the last 20 years. So you can apply it back a little farther than that. So we're talking about 24. And we've had six now in the last 48 hours. So theoretically, to get to that average, you'd have 18 more yet to come, not only in June, July, and probably even early August.
And here's a question I imagine a lot of people have. Is there any particular part of the state that is more prone to tornadoes than others, or is it really a tornado just an equal opportunity storm that can happen anywhere?
Yeah, pretty much an equal opportunity storm that can happen anywhere. The boundary that these very strong thunderstorms have developed upon happens to be sitting in southern Minnesota, southwestern, south-central Wisconsin. That's why the tornadic storms in the last couple of days have been along that boundary, along that line. In central northern Wisconsin, there have been some very strong thunderstorms, but because it's away from that boundary, they're not of a tornadic variety. They're more of a wind producer and some large hail and some heavy rainfall. Then you compound that into southern and southwestern Wisconsin and add in a tornadic effect. So that's why it's just been a little stronger there. But pretty much all of Wisconsin has been affected by some pretty strong storms here in the last 2 days.
It also seems to me that, remembering from weather reporting from when I was younger, that it's a lot better these days in terms of the ability to get some really up-to-date information about where a tornado is and whether it's developing and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just it is the biggest thing is being able to get the word out and get those warnings out. And the warning process for severe thunderstorms and tornado warnings has come a long ways in the last couple of years, especially in the last few years with a new Doppler radar type called dual polarization. It allows you to see a little better into the storm. So, the better you can get the word out, the better you can keep people safe. And, those are things that, unfortunately, in southern Wisconsin's case where we had those six tornadoes, it was a nighttime event where a lot of people had already gone to bed, and you're just hopeful that someone has a cell phone that can receive a tornado warning or some kind of weather radio or an app on their phones to help them notify that because it was such a late night event.
Or in my case, I had a siren that was approximately 6 inches from my head. It woke me
up. That would be a good way to wake you up too as well.
Yeah, once I got off the ceiling, everything was fine. Well, Chad, thanks so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Enjoy your time. Thank you so much and have a good afternoon.
Yeah, you too. Chad Franzen with us there, a meteorologist for WSAW-TV in Wausau.
It's time for a weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. As conflict continues to heat up in Iraq, President Obama spoke with leaders from both parties in Congress earlier this afternoon about what steps the United States might take in response.
And after last week's surprise primary loss by House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, the debate continues in the Republican Party over who should take his place.
Paul Singer joins us each week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Nice to be back. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Well, so far, so good.
All right. Well, President Obama meeting with leaders from both parties to talk about Iraq. What was the president bringing to the table at that meeting?
Well, in fact, it's still going on, or it may have just actually broken up. Basically, the president has said pretty clearly he does not intend to put people on the ground, boots on the ground in Iraq again. The problem is, of course, without that, it's not clear what else we can do to support the Iraqi government in trying to fight off these insurgents. Keep in mind, we're not big fans of the Iraqi government to start with. We're very unhappy with Prime Minister Maliki. We're very unhappy with the way they have built their government on a very sectarian basis. They've alienated a lot of people. We don't have great relationships there. We don't have great intelligence there is the other problem. I believe part of the conversation has been, you know, it's not clear that we know enough to know what to bomb where.
And what are we hearing from members of Congress?
Bit of a mix, really. Mm-hmm. You know, there is some sort of a hawkish wing, I guess you would say, you know, the McCains and the Lindsey Graham, you know, who will say, well, we should definitely be bombing and we should, you know, help Iraq fight these guys off. Keep in mind, at one point, McCain was saying, it would be fine with me if we were in Iraq for 100 years. I think his point was basically that an American presence is going to be necessary to stabilize that country for a long time. I think that's actually a minority view now. Now the question is, can you be a little bit at war? You know, can you send in drones? Can you send in air power without sending Americans into harm's way and getting us back engaged in a war that I think the American people clearly have said they wanted no part of, or they want no part of now? They've just worn out on it. There's not a lot of good options here.
You mentioned a couple of the senators who have been characterized as hawks on this issue and in the past. How about the more libertarian wing of the Republican Party, people like Senator Rand Paul, who's been accused at least of having an isolationist foreign policy? Have we heard from them on this?
No. And that's where you get into this really interesting question for folks like, you know, Rand Paul and some of the other Tea Party members who really do believe, for philosophical reasons, in a much more limited extension of U.S. power, that we should not be getting involved in conflicts all over the world. This one is a really tough challenge. I mean, you've got a group of the most bloodthirsty people, frankly. If you've seen any of the pictures that have been published of, you know, massacres being carried out by this jihadi group, who apparently is sufficiently unhinged that even al-Qaeda didn't really want much to do with them. But they're also in a position now to conquer significant parts of northern Iraq into Syria, and it becomes possibly a terrorist factory that we would have to respond to for years. So what do you do? I mean, this is exactly why I don't want to be president of the United States, and I think a lot of people don't, because there's no real good answers.
Members from both parties criticized the Obama administration for not informing them about the prisoner exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, captured in Afghanistan. Is today's meeting maybe a way to mend fences and say, hey, I am going to talk to you guys?
Well, you know, that's possible. I think the better way to look at it is if you remember how Obama handled Syria, is that he basically announced that we were about ready to bomb Syria for the use of chemical weapons. And then, after sort of a week of dissatisfaction from Congress, he pulled back and said, okay, well, let's ask Congress's permission and get them involved. And my suspicion is that this is more like that kind of situation, where Obama wants to be able to say that he had congressional approval before he launched any strike, that he had briefed Congress, he had kept them informed in the loop, and that there was some level of agreement that this was an important thing to do.
Well, he's meeting with congressional leadership. One of those leaders is changing after his primary loss. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said he's stepping down as House Majority Leader. Looked like this could be an epic battle, establishment Republican Party, Tea Party, trying to get this key leadership spot, and where are we at now?
Well, at the moment, the majority leader spot, I think, is a pretty easy deal. There's the current number three in the Republican leadership, a guy named Kevin McCarthy from California, is very likely to be able to move into that seat without a great deal of trouble. There's mm-hmm. one candidate against him, a kind of Tea Party guy from Colorado named Raul Labrador, who doesn't really have the resources to compete with the majority whip, whose job is, after all, counting votes. So when he wants to get voted up to the next job, he probably has the votes to do it. The more interesting possibility is what's going to happen after the elections in November. I mean, I think for the Tea Party groups, they feel like this race, these elections in the next, you know, tomorrow, are really just placeholders. After the elections in November, a whole new crop comes in, and you get a chance to have what is essentially a referendum on the entire Republican leadership, including the Speaker of the House. I am almost certain there will be somebody who wants to challenge John Boehner for his seat as Speaker. Whether they'll win or not is a different question, but that's when they're going to want to make their stand. I don't think they're going to make a big splash this week.
And they're hoping that they will control both houses. Republicans are at that point, so a leadership position is maybe a bigger deal then.
Right, and you know, for all of these senior positions, keep in mind, I mean, the majority leader is assumed to be the next in line for the speakership if the speaker leaves for whatever reason. There has been some rumors over time that John Boehner might be ready to leave because, frankly, being the Speaker of this House has been so annoying. But we'll see. I mean, it depends partly, exactly as you said, on what the outcome of the elections are. If the Republicans strengthen the majority in their House and take the Senate, you know, these positions become really leading the country.
Well, whoever wins these votes within Congress may not get a lot of love from the rest of the country. A new Gallup poll out earlier this week showing Congress again dipping lower, lowest approval rating in a midterm election year in at least four decades, 16% approval of Congress.
Right, right. But keep in mind that the president's approval ratings are also going down. Mm. It's not clear which party benefits from that. I think the thing that is clear, and I think the Eric Cantor election showed that, that there's just a real dismay with Washington in general. If you've had anything to do with Washington, you are seen in a very harsh light. But since there are both Democrats and Republican incumbents running for re-election, it's hard to know how that sorts out in November, which ones suffer worst. I think clearly for the Democrats, they are at risk in more places, in the Senate particularly, so maybe that's worse news for them.
So something that I gather is being talked about a lot in Washington today and something members of Congress have talked about was Washington's National Football League team lost
Yes, sir.
The trademark over its name. The trademark commission said it's disparaging to Native Americans. I didn't know that you could withdraw a trademark. What does that mean? What's the buzz around Washington on this?
Well, I mean, you know, the first version of the buzz is that there are people who have said for years that the Washington Redskins is an offensive name for a football team and it should be changed. And the current owner of the team, Dan Snyder, is a litigious and unpleasant person most of the time. So he's never been really willing to talk about this much. Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, went to the floor this morning after this trademark case and said, basically, the writing is on the wall. The name is going to change. Let's start deciding the new name. So, of course, you know, every news organization and every Twitter feed and everything else is talking about what do you want to call them? The Washington Red Tapes or something. But it's hard to know. I mean, the team has already said they're going to challenge this. The last time this happened in the 1980s, similar ruling from a similar panel at the U.S. Patent Office, it was ultimately overturned by a judge. So, you know, still a long road to go, but it's hard to imagine in modern times that you could carry on with a name like this much longer, but who knows?
In other congressional sports news, I guess there's a big baseball, softball game going on out there?
The big softball game, yeah. There's an annual women's congressional softball game as a fundraiser for breast cancer, and it's become a great event. It's women member of Congress playing softball against women reporters who cover Congress. And it's at this community center on Capitol Hill, and it's a great event. I mean, Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner will probably both show up and cheer on their team. There's all kinds of trash talk going on online, and the women members of Congress and the women reporters sort of, oh yeah, watch out, buddy, I'm going to get you at third base. It's hilarious, and it's a great game, and it's a great cause, and everyone shows up, and I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the captain of the women's team, and if you follow her Twitter feed at all, you'll see, you know, Democratic politics salted nicely with softball. So, yeah, that'll be 7 o'clock tonight, assuming we don't get rained out by the weather.
Sounds like a fun break from a lot of what else goes on in Congress. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Rob. You guys be well.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to take us behind the scenes and out of left field in Congress.
Some linguists believe that language shapes the way we perceive the world. So, for example, in Japanese, one word means both green and blue. But in Russian, there are different terms for light blue and for dark blue. And some would argue that this means that these two cultures perceive colors differently.
Our guest says, not really, no. And he calls it the language hoax. John McWhorter is with us. He's the author of The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language. He's a professor of linguistics at Columbia University. John, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start by getting a sense of what you're arguing against in your book. It's called the Sapir-Whorf Hypothesis from the World of Linguistics. In a nutshell, what does it say?
Yeah, never mind that technical-sounding title.
Oh, but I like technical titles.
Basically, what we're talking about is the idea that depending on the language you speak and how its words divide up the world, such as what words it applies to which colors and which lines between them it uses, and its grammar and what sorts of things you have to say in the language as opposed to which kinds of things you don't. So our language requires us to indicate that something's plural by using the S. There are many languages where you barely have to do that and you leave it to context. Languages vary in hundreds of ways of that sort. The idea is that depending on how your language divides up the world, you look at the language, you look at the world in a particular way. And so it means that the Russian language, not Russian culture, but the Russian language means that to speak Russian is to look at the world through a certain pair of glasses, whereas to speak the Chinese language, not to be a Chinese person, but to speak that language is to have your view of the world filtered in a certain way. And I think that a lot of people find that notion really neat. Right now, there's a feature running on Slate that's been sitting there for days teaching people more of the language hoax. And I think we like it for various reasons. I personally would find it really neat if that's the way things were. But the fact is, it isn't. And people who've been studying this have been showing again and again that the idea that there are different worldviews based on your language really doesn't hold up. And I think the idea is more dangerous than we think. So I decided to write a book about it.
Dangerous, how so?
In that, in a nutshell, there are as many ways that the language you speak could paint you as a bit of a dummy as there are that it could paint you as somebody who sees the world more perceptively than we do. And so if, for example, we want to say that because Russian has separate words for light and dark blue, then that means that to be Russian is to perceive gradations of blue more vividly. We can enjoy that. But then what about the fact that over in Chinese, for example, there are many fewer words for indicating counterfactuality, hypotheticality, fine grades of distinction, like I would have done this if this person had seen me. In Chinese, you can get along without using explicit words to indicate things like that. It's a much more telegraphic language than we English speakers are used to. And that's true of hundreds and hundreds of languages, especially in Asia. Well, you know, there's actually a psychologist who tried to argue that that meant that to be Chinese, to use that language, is to be somebody who doesn't process counterfactuality and hypotheticality as rapidly and readily as English speakers. And notice how you don't want to hear that. There's nothing romantic about it. You don't want to see a newspaper article about that. And you immediately think, well, it must be that everybody thinks the same way. It's just the languages that differ. Well, if you want the grits, you have to take the gravy. And I think that all the evidence is that languages are very different, and that's fascinating in many ways, as I've written about in many places. But the idea that they all give us different pairs of glasses doesn't work unless you want to accept that the ways that many people are looking at the world through their languages are actually making them seem pretty crummy. And if we don't, then we just have to let the whole thing go.
Well, you make the point in your book that this isn't just an obscure linguistics debate. This has bled over into popular culture. And I want to play a bit from a Game of Thrones on HBO that illustrates mm-hmm. one of the points you bring up.
Ser Jorah, I don't know how to say thank you in Dothraki.
There is no word for thank you in Dothraki.
So, the Dothraki, these mean, warlike people have no word for thank you. This tells us something about how they view the world. Now, that's fiction. You point out a culture that has no word, I think, for winning and losing. So that must mean they're a non-competitive culture if they've got no word for that category.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a distinction that has to be made here. Cultures do differ. We all see that. And a language, of course, is indexed to a culture in many ways. And so it could be that there is a culture where there is no such thing as expressing thanks for people, and there'd be no word for it. However, it's highly unlikely. You know, Dothraki, if it were a real language, would almost certainly have some way of saying, I am glad that you gave me this because you didn't have to, even if there wasn't a phrase that translated directly as thank you. And in terms of the language that supposedly had no words for win or lose, it was Berber. And as you can imagine, there's no such thing as a language where children don't engage in games where somebody comes out on top and somebody comes out on the bottom. They do have words for it. And so very, very often, when you hear that a language doesn't have a word for something, it does. Or if it doesn't, you know that it doesn't mean anything. And so, for example, talk to a Scandinavian sometime. Ask a Dane or a Norwegian whether they have a word for to wipe. And not just to dry something off, but a word that specifically means to take some wet rag and to clean something up. They don't have a word that translates to wipe.
But I could still eat off the table in Scandinavia.
Yeah, and they wipe. And so if we don't want to say that they don't have that concept, then we have to let the rest of it go.
So the idea here is that we all have our language toolkit, I guess, and even if that specific tool is not available, we and the evolution of language is clever enough to work around and make do with what we've got?
Very much so. And if we resist that because it's kind of fun to imagine that some people see blue more poppingly than we do, or some people sense time differently, then we just wind up having to put up with so much that is less pleasant that it isn't worth it. And it really just comes down to one more thing. English. You know, we're always hearing about obscure tribes and how they must see the world differently, or Russians who aren't an obscure tribe, but I think we tend to exotify Russians somewhat for various reasons. But what about English? What's the worldview from this language we're speaking right now? And notice how absurd the question seems to be. We're not looking at the world through a view conditioned by the structures of English. We're looking at the world because of culture, and especially what would be the worldview if you were Australian and I was American. And as I say in the book, if we're going to talk about a worldview from English, we're talking about a worldview that would be shared by Mary Tyler Moore, William Jennings Bryan, Sting, a black kid in Jersey City, me, the reader, and you. And let's face it, there is no worldview between those six people that anybody would be interested in knowing about. English is a language. Then there are cultures. That's what differentiates people.
Well, but, you know, a fish may not be aware that it's swimming around in water, and an octopus might not be, and a mollusk doesn't know what all that stuff is, but they all exist in it, and it says something, I don't know, about their body chemistry or something. Couldn't there still be some subtle level where that language is pointing me, you, and William Jennings Bryan all in the same direction?
That's a very good point. And if one were going to tease out something that English contributes that would mean that, say, Benjamin Harrison and you and me all had something in common, the problem is it would be some tiny little whisper of a thing. And a very important thing to get in here is that studies have shown that these differences between languages do condition teeny little whispers of psychological difference in terms of how fast somebody will respond to some cue. And that in itself is very interesting. I teach it in my classes. But the question is whether those teeny little differences are a worldview. So, yeah, Mary Tyler Moore and me, I'm very fond of Mary Tyler Moore as an icon. She and I probably do share something mentally that somebody from Norway or China does not have based on how English's verbs work. But whatever it is it a world view? Not the way we're being sold it. And we're being sold a version of this that is not anything that any working psychologist is claiming.
And you talk about some experiments where, people with different, words for colors, again, the Russian dark blue, light blue, perceive a difference between colors a little faster. But how big was that difference?
It was teeny, 124 milliseconds on average. And so on the one hand, it is really neat that just speaking a language where there are different words for dark and light blue means that on the average, people are a teeny weeny bit faster at hitting a button when there's a difference between dark and light blue happening. That is fantastic. But does it mean that someone in Russia is seeing the world differently? And as soon as we start falling for the idea that maybe it does, then we also have to accept that the Chinese are a little bit dumb. It's the exact same kind of argument. And if we don't want to accept that about the Chinese, then we have to let it go about the Russians and their colors and everything else that happens to taste good when we see studies like this.
We're talking to linguist John McWhorter about his new book. It's called The Language Hoax. He argues that people perceive the world pretty much the same, divided by cultures, sure, but in spite of language differences.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. What do you think about this idea of the language hoax? Do you think that language reflects how the speaker experiences the world, or do you agree with our guest that we all experience it in sort of the same way? What do you think about that? Do you speak more than one language, and how do those languages express things differently? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also join in by email. That address is talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation now with linguist John McWhorter about his new book, The Language Hoax. In it, he argues that people perceive things the same despite language differences.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about that idea? Do you think that different languages around the world shape the way people think? Fundamentally, they see the world, feel the world differently than people who speak a language different than their own? And do you speak more than one language? Raised bilingual or learned something later in life? How do those languages shape the way you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll get to your calls in just a few moments. But first, John, you say you feel like you're kind of bursting some people's bubble. It's nice, people think about all these unique worldviews. But maybe there's a positive here that we're able to communicate with each other successfully.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one thing that we also like about the whole Whorfianism, as it's called, is that we want to understand, and we want to show that we understand, that you don't have to be a first world person with tall buildings and therapy, et cetera, to be a legitimate human being. I think it's part of being an educated person to understand that all peoples are equal. But I think we're led into a sense that the way to do that is partly to exotify the other. The idea is to show how they're better than us in certain ways. And as neat as that is, it ends up being scientifically dishonest. And I also argue in one chapter of the book that ultimately there's a certain condescension in a lot of it. And that really the lesson that is to be learned is that no matter what a language is like, all people are cognitively equal, and languages are a great way to show that. And it's certainly not that cultures don't differ. Cultures differ massively. But the question is whether the language you're speaking is what's creating the difference as opposed to it being the culture. And I think that whenever you look at it, it's always a matter of cultures differ. It's not what you're speaking that makes you different.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mary on the line in Green Bay. Mary, hi.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I may have missed out on some key points here. You used the word just recently, whorfism, and so my first question was whether you were familiar with the work of Benjamin Whorf, because I read his book when I graduated from college, and that was quite a few decades ago. But his primary point was that there are a lot of languages, all the Romance languages, divide the world into subjects and verbs, a doer and an action, something, subjects and verbs. And we do that kind of unconsciously. He likened it to the beams in a house, that you don't see the structure that's actually holding the building together because it's plastered over with the walls and all of our cultural things and all that kind of thing.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. And John, you did mention Benjamin Whorf earlier, but what about that idea of, subject to verb, having a doer and a done, and that shapes the way we approach the world?
Yeah, I think very quickly we can say that Yeah, Benjamin Lee Whorf's work, of course, is largely what stimulated the dominance of this whole idea now, and we did happen to bring that word up in the beginning of our discussion, and certainly I discuss him in the book. And, you know, it turned out he was very well-intentioned, but a lot of his work was based on the Native American language Hopi, and he didn't really know the language very well, and he actually based some really, really shaky claims on it with good intentions. I don't mean that he was some sort of hack or anything like that. But in terms of subjects and verbs, yeah, all languages have that. But I think what the caller might be referring to is claims, for example, that some languages are more active, that subjects are more doy in English than in some other languages. Other languages are more likely to couch a sentence in which the subject is less the center of the action. And when you look at that difference between languages, you see that it never correlates at all with what the people are like culturally, although many people are thinking that it's that England went and conquered the world, but then so did many other countries. But more to the point, the reason a language gets doy like that often has nothing to do with psychology or culture, and often it just has to do with what the history of the language and its learners was like in terms of what happened to the grammar for very mundane reasons. And so I definitely see where the caller's coming from, but Whorf's ideas have been reexamined. I, too, was given Whorf in college, and I found it absolutely fascinating. But you don't learn that all of that has been torn down, even including by psychologists today who are doing neo-Whorfianism, which is a very different thing.
Mary, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Nancy with us in Whitewater. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I speak four languages. English was my second language, and I guess the way I would see it is when you build fluency in more than one language and are able to interact in a variety of ways and cultures, your perspective becomes more than 360 degrees. Everything you see, everything you engage on, the problem solving and the engagement in whatever it is that you do is multifaceted. There's not one thing that I do that I don't really see more than one way of doing it or more than one way at arriving at a certain place. And part of that has to do with the languages and the ability to be able to look at things differently.
Nancy, do you think that's based on, you know, the process of having learned those languages and the effort it takes to go to that third and fourth language? Or do you feel like there's something internal within those languages that makes you look at things in a different perspective?
All of it. You know, each language has its own perspective, even the way that you engage as a male and female, the masculine and feminine of many other of the languages that I speak. The other one is the process. You know, it takes a tremendous amount of endurance and persistence to learn a language and the ability to make mistakes. You know, you have to make a tremendous amount of errors before you arrive at a language. You babble before you engage in real conversation. So you really have to engage in more than one way.
Nancy,
so,
thanks a lot. I want to jump in and get John in on this. So she feels like there's something about the languages she's learned that gives her different perspectives, John.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I would say this. Being bilingual or multilingual has definite cognitive benefits, and that's just been shown. But the question, which you've basically already asked, is whether that has something to do with the internal structure of the languages. And so, for example, if one or several of the languages in question are ones that divide things into masculine and feminine, if we're talking about a table being a girl and, say, a boat being a boy, that kind of abstract gender, that's a perfect example of one of those things where psychological experiments have shown that if you speak a language with that, you are an itsy-bitsy more likely to imagine that object as having a gender, so to speak, than an English speaker is. But then do we want to say that it's really giving you a perspective on the world? And in that case, with all due respect to the caller, I don't mean to sound sassy or flippant or anything like that, and I am not multilingual. Is that really a perspective on the world to think about some objects as girls and others as boys? And then once again, I don't mean to be repetitious. Right now I'm looking out my office window. I'm seeing people surrounding a baby carriage, all of whom are clearly of East Asian descent. Do I wish to say, given that their languages are very scanty on indicating the plurality of things, that they don't perceive plurality as much as we do? I don't want to say it, and therefore I can't praise anybody for what their language has in it.
Well, that brings me to a question that you bring up in your book. if all these languages approach so many of these basic fundamental issues so very differently, gender of nouns or ways we handle plural things, why is there such variety?
You know, the reason there's such variety, and that's an interesting question, and unfortunately it doesn't have the answer we want. You want to say they have such variety because cultures are so different. And the tragedy is that's not the reason. The reason is because languages diverge when populations diverge, and they diverge based on reasons that are founded in chance. And so if I let a tap run on the back of my hand, some of the water is going to go down to the left, some of it's going to go to the right, some of it's going to go down between the fingers, and it would be different every time we did it. And so languages differ in completely unpredictable and yet magnificent ways. And so we want to say, well, Japanese is the way it is because of them. But no, if we rolled the tape again, a language that would work like Japanese would be spoken by some Native Americans or by somebody in Mexico. It's just chance. Now, cultures differ, yes, but what the language is like does not correlate with them in the way that we very understandably think that they do.
You know, there's concern about languages disappearing from the world. I think there's a group called the Language Preservation Society finding indigenous languages around the world going away in a lot of cases. If these languages don't carry a different perspective, a different worldview, should we worry if we lose them and that language heritage?
That is the grimiest implication of my book, and I'm not even going to sugarcoat it, which is that if the way languages worked did correspond with what was in people's heads culturally, that would be a great justification for keeping languages alive. And I think that's part of why it's such a popular idea among so many linguists and anthropologists and others, because the public is immediately interested in it. It definitely is a great way to raise awareness. However, I think the fact is, languages need to be kept alive or at least documented because they're magnificent in themselves. The argument needs to more be one about of the kind that's made by environmentalists. There's an argument about ecosystems and their interdependability, but there's an extent to which it's also said that this is just a magnificent creature, a magnificent plant. This is a gorgeous creation. Languages are like that too, and I think that argument is the one that is more scientifically honest, and I hope that the public can be made to understand it if more linguists try to get that message across. Because, yeah, I am saying that if a language spoken by a small group of interesting people is dying, what they speak is not them in the way that we're often talking about. Their culture is them, but the language is just really, really cool because it has evolved for chance reasons among them into something that's the equivalent of, you know, the Notre Dame Cathedral.
We'll leave it there. John McWhorter, his new book is The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language. He's a professor of linguistics at Columbia University.